AI, Elon Musk, and the first AI elections.
If we think that the cat's out of the bag, then it's like, oh, we can't do anything about it, right? But I think that we very clearly can do something about it.
Wait for that. I'm your host, Justin Lang, and I'm here with Paris Marks, author of the Disconnect newsletter, host of the Tech Won't Save Us podcast, and all-around smart person. Paris, thanks for being here.
Yeah, great to be back.
AI is making it harder for all of us to know what to trust in this election cycle.
Yeah, Justin Trudeau? No thanks. Justin Ling? Yes, please.
But with the very real possibility of AI fakes...
I think Justin Ling is a stand-up guy. Great journalist. One of the best. Sign up for his Substack.
Citizens and candidates will face a flood of falsehoods that suffocate serious civic debate.
Heard him on Canada Land, and I thought I love Canada. I love land, and I love Ling. That's a trifecta.
I love that so much. It's so stupid. Absolutely idiotic. Paris, stop me if you've heard this one before. The dawn of generative AI and large language models will mean a deluge of misinformation. Our elections will never be safe again. We are careening towards the end of truth. Yes, due to the mass proliferation of artificial intelligence, the internet and our society more broadly will be filled with images, songs, books, movies, and ideas cooked up by a series of algorithms on a server somewhere, sucking up more electricity than a stack of Prince Edward Islands. We thought we had more time, but unfortunately, tech writer Nick Bilton welcomed us recently in the pages of Vanity Fair to the AI election. Facing dizzying deepfakes and personalized propaganda, Bilton writes that the 2024 election cycle has been a turning point in the use of AI for political manipulation. And at the center of it, we have Elon Musk yet again to thank. Due to his sassy, non-woke free speech alternative, Grok, released as a competitor to ChatGPT and Gemini and all of the others, Grok has been a minor player on the AI scene. But maybe we discounted Grok at our own peril. The large language model is now stuffing the election full of misinformation, Donald Trump memes, and anti-woke agitprop. Could this be a sign of things to come here in Canada? Well, we're going to find out. Paris, have we finally arrived at the end of truth ushered in by artificial intelligence?
I don't think so.
All right, well... That's the show.
How many times have I heard that before? You know, like, obviously it will present new obstacles, new things that we need to get around. But I think with a lot of this AI stuff, like, people can usually suss out, like, what is real and what is not. You know, maybe it's not always the case, but I think for the vast majority of people, that is true. I'm just not so concerned. Like, they were saying a lot of this about the Indian election as well, but I read a report in Rest of World recently that said, you know, everyone's expecting AI to, like, you know, lead to all this misinformation in India. And that didn't happen. You know, we'll see if it's going to happen here. I didn't hear much about it in the European elections that happened recently. So I don't know. I'm not really buying it at the moment.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of the warnings we've gotten, and we're going to break a lot of this down in some granular detail in a second, but just like at a high level, I feel like all of the things we were warned about now started happening. Like, we're dealing with them, right? Like, over the last year, we've seen instances of an AI Joe Biden doing robocalls in New Hampshire, telling voters to stay home.
It's important that you save your vote for the November election. Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again.
There's an AI Taylor Swift who endorsed Donald Trump. There's Stable Diffusion images of big pro-Trump crowds, memes of gun-toting Trump and a wheelchair-bound Biden, you know, or more recently, these crazy memes of Donald Trump protecting our cats and dogs from, you know, from the roaming bands of migrants who want to eat your pets. Like, it feels like all of the things we worried about have happened, like all the crazy use cases are here. And it genuinely just sort of feels like they're not having much of an impact. And I think that's really interesting.
You know, it's easier to churn that stuff out now. It can happen quicker because we have these tools. But it's not like it was never possible to do these things in the past. Yeah. I remember, you know, through the Trump term and stuff, we would always be having these images of, like, Trump with this really muscular build and stuff, showing him as, like, you know, leading the country into its great, wonderful future and all this sort of stuff. Like, it's not wholly new. It just took a bit more work to do that stuff then. And sure, it's polluting the ecosystem and, like, polluting what we see to a certain degree. But I'm really skeptical that the misinformation side of this is, like, the key thing that we need to be most worried about. Sure, we should be on guard. We should make sure that it doesn't become a big thing. But I feel like we often get these warnings and then it doesn't really result in like what we expect to happen.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go back to what Nick Bilton wrote in Vanity Fair, because he seems quite worried about all of this in a way that I read through this and I'm having a hard time sharing his level of concern. But he writes, once you start living in the land of AI, your brain starts to question everything, whether you like it or not. You begin to get a creeping suspicion that even the most straightforward images are indeed fake. I live in this space a lot. I don't experience any of this.
No, like, me neither.
Every once in a while, I'll see an image being like, and I'll really stare at it and go, okay, is this real? Is this? But like, I feel like I'm already tuned to recognizing at least kind of general kind of category of true and fake. And like, yeah, maybe I do a second step to verify stuff now that I wouldn't have done a couple years ago, but doesn't seem so bad.
I feel like when we talk about American politics in particular, and, you know, I'm sure more broadly as well, but there is often this kind of inflating of the role of technology in what is actually happening there. Like, you know, we can go back to 2016 and, you know, what came after that and all of the concern about, you know, Russian meddling in the election and how it was using Facebook and whatnot. There was certainly a bit of that, like Russia was buying ads on Facebook and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, it also served to cover over some of the deficiencies in the Democratic campaign. So they didn't have to talk about those things and could just say, oh, it was all Russia and they put Trump in and blah, blah, blah. Right. I'm not saying it's the same thing as that, but it does feel like we tend to overstate the potential impacts of technology on these things so that we don't need to talk about more kind of base and fundamental political things and material things that are actually happening here.
The point we're making here, I don't want to have a conversation that just says, don't worry, everything's fine. What I think is way more interesting is that AI is already starting having an impact in other ways, just not exactly as we anticipated. And I think this example of all of these, you know, Donald Trump protecting our cats and dogs and geese and ducks, I guess, memes are part of this, in that AI has not become a tool in this case to dupe people. It's become a fun participatory action that everyone can do to kind of contribute to the political propaganda process. And I think that is way more fascinating than, you know, little old ladies being tricked online into thinking that Donald Trump is literally putting himself between a gunman and a bunch of cats, right?
Definitely. And, you know, in the past, you could have done a bit more work to try to Photoshop something like that. But now it's easy just to hop onto like Stable Diffusion or Midjourney or whatever other app people are using to do this kind of stuff and churn out an image and throw it out there. And people laugh at it for a minute, but then they forget about it, you know, not too long after, because the news cycle moves on and the next thing moves through. I think it's not surprising that people use these tools in weird ways when they're put out to the general public. But I would say that there are definitely nefarious parts of AI, generative AI and AI more broadly, but it's not so much the image generator stuff and the fun stuff like that, right?
You know, one thing that I feel like people don't fully appreciate, because we often talk about AI as being this sort of monolith, but the reality is you have, because it's really stratified types of AI. You have the big services. Like, I use Midjourney a lot for my Substack, and I've learned recently that they have guardrails. I can make images of Trump, but not Harris. I can't do Tim Walz. I can't do JD Vance, only Trump, which I think is interesting. But there's more and more restrictions about what I can and can't generate. This is true for Stable Diffusion. This is true for a bunch of the big ones. But then we have sort of all down the line different options, including Elon Musk's own proprietary AI service. So, like, tell me a little bit about the guardrail free type of AI.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, and to be clear, like, we're talking about generative AI specifically, right? AI is this broad term that's been around since the 1950s that refers to a lot of things. Like, when you're seeing autocorrect on your phone or you're typing a document and that little line comes under it to say, like, it's probably spelled wrong. That's AI too, right? Just a very much more rudimentary form of it. And so when we're talking about generative AI in these systems, like, whether it's chatbots like ChatGPT or image generators like Stable Diffusion or Midjourney, they need to put certain restrictions on what you're going to get out of it to make that user experience good, but also, you know, to try to not get in trouble, right? There was a story last year that OpenAI had paid these Kenyan workers, you know, contract workers, as much as $2 an hour, basically, to go through like some of the most vile content on the internet, right? To try to scrub it from ChatGPT itself. Like, this is some of the labor that goes into doing these sorts of things. As a result of, you know, decisions like that, someone like Elon Musk, who talks a lot about free speech and the woke mind virus and these kind of right-wing conspiracy theories these days, said that ChatGPT and the products that come from OpenAI are infected by the woke mind virus. They won't let you do or get what you want from it. So he wanted to create this version of a generative AI chatbot or image generator that would have many fewer restrictions on it, let you do much more with it. And of course, it's not just Elon Musk that's doing that. There are a lot of other tools, a lot of other generative AI tools that are trying to do the same thing that are used in very, I would say, nefarious and harmful ways.
Like, what's some real examples here? Because putting aside that, you know, a lot of the real fear-mongering has not yet come to pass, and I think increasingly we're of the opinion that it probably won't. Like, what are the bad edge use cases that we're starting to see come from this sort of wild west of generative AI?
Yeah, so the real key one to me that I think doesn't get the attention it deserves is obviously deepfakes, right? And we talk a lot about deepfakes in the political sense of like, okay, you can make Joe Biden say something he didn't say or Donald Trump say something he didn't say. But actually what we're seeing is, in particular, photos of women being taken and putting into these apps and to churn out nude and explicit images of them, right? There was a big controversy around this involving Taylor Swift earlier this year that I think brought it to some more people's attention. But really, this is happening across society to people who are not famous as well. There are a number of issues around the world now of high schools and junior highs where students, where boys are kind of taking pictures of their female classmates and putting them into these apps and making nude images of them and sharing it around with their friends, right? And this is really harmful, like psychologically to the people who are involved. I've spoken to journalists who have looked into this deeper and spoken to women who basically said that, like, I want to retreat from public life because there are people taking images of me and putting them into these apps. You know, if we're talking about generated images and stuff, this is the really difficult and really harmful piece of it that the companies don't really want to talk very much about and try to kind of wipe their hands of, but they're very much involved in allowing those sorts of things to happen. And we're starting to see some legislative moves in the United States and some other countries. I'm not aware so much of it happening in Canada at the moment, but I think that something like that needs to happen much quicker because that is where, like, you know, we talk a lot about misinformation and whatnot, but I think that is where the real, you know, human harm is.
So anyway, I think someone in Canada is trying to go down this path, but it's difficult. And I think this exposes how hard it is to deal with everything in this space. You can criminalize the actual downstream kind of action, right? Like the actual act of creating the image, which I think is a no-brainer idea in the same way that taking creep shots of people in public also can be criminalized in certain circumstances, sharing the images, ditto. And obviously, you'd hope that we can figure out a way to regulate some of the bigger AI companies into putting up the necessary guardrails and banning users who do this. But again, you deal with this thing where if we're going to see the mass proliferation of open source AI models, as we're increasingly starting to see, thanks to Facebook's Llama generative AI LLM and others, whether it's Grok or other companies that make Grok-like equivalents.
Yeah, Microsoft has been accused of allowing this kind of thing to happen with their tools as well, right?
If anybody can kind of run their own AI in any country, you know, without any sort of particular legislative control over what they do, it feels kind of like the cat's already out of the bag.
I would maybe push back on that to say that if we think that the cat's out of the bag, then it's like, oh, we can't do anything about it, right? But I think that we very clearly can do something about it. And whether it is looking at the people who use it rather than the people who create it, or even the people who create it as well, like if they're in Canada and they're accessible to, you know, Canadian authorities and the Canadian government, then that is something that can be done. On top of all that are a bunch of structural issues too, right? The massive amount of energy that these things require, the water to cool them, and how we're seeing the emissions from these major tech companies, Google, Microsoft, and others, just go through the roof as they kind of ignore their pledges to power this generative AI build out. But then, you know, we see governments rolling out AI technologies that are promoted as being more efficient, but often mean that services are pulled back from residents or there's more discrimination built into the system. And these are some of the other bigger issues that we're seeing with this as well.
Stick around after the break and we'll talk about what we can actually do in Canada to limit the negative effects of this technology. Plus, we'll hear a captivating duet between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. I'm having a hard time with it because it does sort of feel like we're going to wind up trying to regulate air, trying to, you know, displace water to some degree. And I really am skeptical that we're going to end up anywhere good. I think more likely we're going to see Canada adopt some like CanCon requirements for AI that I can't imagine is going to exactly make us either a functional regulatory state here or a welcome place for tech innovation.
I would say I'm definitely more skeptical of that. You know, I think that there's a lot of ways that we can look at regulating these things. And what we're really seeing is that over the past couple of decades, there's kind of been this like acceptance, right? That we can't really regulate technology. It's difficult to do, you know, when it comes to the internet specifically. And I think in recent years, we've really seen that begin to break down, particularly when it comes to the power that, you know, in many cases, these American tech companies have developed over, you know, our digital economies and whatnot. Obviously, Europe has been a real leader with its, you know, general data protection regulations, its Digital Markets Act, and, you know, various other regulatory measures that it has brought in to try to rein in these tech companies. But, you know, Canada has done a number of things recently that some people criticize, but I think were largely good moves to move us forward. Australia is moving even more aggressively than Canada at trying to rein some of these things in. So I think that we're seeing a real shift in, you know, this idea that we couldn't regulate the internet. And now the question is, what is the right way to do it to make sure that, yes, we can have access to these technologies if we deem them something that is worthwhile for society, but we also make sure that the negative sides of these things are properly, you know, reined in, considered, regulated. And that is something where the government has a role. And traditionally, when we think of other, you know, media and communications, whether it's broadcasting or radio or what have you, the expectation that the government would be somehow involved was always there. And that only really broke down with the internet itself. And I think that that's changing. And I think that that's welcome.
So listen, I'm a big, kind of a recent convert to the antitrust world. I'm now firmly in the, like, break up everything, just like a wrecking ball, smash these companies to bits, 100%. But when it comes to a lot of the other regulations, I'm just looking at, you know, like the GDPR is a great example. The EU tells all these companies, you need to start respecting consumer privacy. And what do we get? Just an absolute deluge of cookie prompts and pop-ups that are just assaulting you wherever you go, that just asks users to just sell out their privacy and allow for tracking. And just everyone does because they're so bored of dealing with these. And the phrase that a lot of people in this space have started using for just this, that, everything, bad AI models, websites, is education. And I think to bring it back to AI's impact on the election, it seems to me that we are infying all political discourse and AI is helping with that. And that seems to me like the real impact. It's not so much in creating more misinformation. It's just creating spaces that suck, just full of generated garbage and low quality bullshit. And I don't think we're quite ready for what that means, because we're simultaneously going more online and also we're making online bad.
I would say that AI is more of a symptom there rather than a cause, right? Because I think that in general, what we see is, say, on the media side of things, the fact that media and journalism has less funding, which means fewer journalists, which means you can't put, you know, the dedicated resources into doing investigative work, that local journalism is evaporating in this country. You know, Post Media just bought Saltwire and proceeded to gut the St. John's Telegram in Newfoundland and Labrador, where I'm from, which, you know, is part of a broader trend that we've seen across the country. But then, you know, when we look at what's been happening online, for a long time, we had this idea that, you know, we were going to have these platforms, they were going to work well, there was going to be a trade-off, we'd have to look at ads, but you know, in general, they work quite well, but it's reached the point where these companies, their shareholders are still demanding high profits, big revenues, growth in their revenues, and they're unable to deliver that in the way that, you know, they used to. And so what we're seeing now is them basically degrading the experience of using it to try to suck a bit more money out of it. And AI kind of fits into that equation as a way to sure throw more content onto the apps or try to extract a bit more revenue from it. So I see AI as a symptom of these broader economic factors.
I'm more depressed now than ever, but stick around as we recap some more of the happenings of this past week. But before that, I'm going to leave you with the dulcet tones of Donald Trump and Kamala Harris doing a duet. Suppose I run with Sasha,
Bowie. Wait how long? Grenades out on my maze and hand for war.
And I don't need to go. Bomb shit, chomp, he shit, chomp, war.
Up when sun moves in.
Paris, we'd like to duly note stories so they don't fall through the cracks. Do you have anything you would like to duly note today?
Yeah, so there's a story by Janice McGregor in CBC looking at this recent announcement by the Foreign Affairs Minister, Melanie Joly, that they're canceling 30 export permits that would have been sending arms from Canadian companies to Israel. This comes after, you know, in January, the government said there would be no new export permits, but that didn't cancel the ones that came before. And the way that this story was originally presented, or the way that I initially encountered it, suggested that, like, okay, these 30 were like the ones that were left over and we're done now and there's no more Canadian arms going to Israel. But this analysis by Janice McGregor in CBC said, well, that's not really the case. There's probably over 200 export permits that are still valid. And so canceling 30, yes, it takes some more down, but there's still a lot of weapons that are going from Canadian companies over to Israel. And some of those are even going to the United States first and then going to Israel from there to try to bypass some of these restrictions. So at the very least, can we stop sending arms from Canada to Israel as it engages in a genocide against the people of Gaza? It's not just me saying that. It's Independent Jewish Voices Canada, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, the founder of Human Rights Watch, and of course, the International Court of Justice ruled earlier this year that Israel was plausibly committing genocide in Gaza, a case that will take some time to get a final verdict. It's really disappointing, but unfortunately, our government can't even do that very minimum bit.
Just pick a lane at a certain point, right? I mean, you know, where does Canada want to be on this conflict? I appreciate that we don't have quite the same foreign policy gravitas that we had, and maybe even that's mythical, but either way, like, do we want to be involved in forcing a ceasefire, in making Netanyahu's, making his government untenable? Do we want to be on the side that tries to push Israel towards peace? Or do we just want to muddle through and let, you know, the Americans fundamentally dictate the world response and that let EU be kind of the voice of conscience? And it seems very clear that we just do not have a sort of strategy, a plan, an ethos, a mission, a statement even. It is so ad hoc, slapdash, and amateur.
Yeah, I remember when the Liberals came to power, Justin Trudeau said Canada is back on the world stage, right? But now it feels like so much of our foreign policy is really just like whatever the United States wants it to be. And I think that the Liberal government stance on what's happening in Gaza right now is going to be a black mark, not just on this Liberal government, but on Canada's legacy here as well.
There's so much room to do it constructively and thoughtfully and effectively, to give voice to the growing number of people here and abroad, including many Jews and Israelis who just are very, very sick of this war, including, by the way, the hostages, his families, who desperately want a friggin' ceasefire deal. Anyway, duly noted. All right, so Paris, as we know, I think as anyone listening knows, Canadian music journalism has not had a fantastic decade. If journalism is hurting anyway, music journalism has been kind of the first thing to go. But it bums me out right now because the Polaris Music Prize was awarded this week. We're recording it right now. We don't know the results. That's okay. But the gala was earlier this week, and I've seen zero buzz about it, zero coverage. And I realize it's an indie music award. It's not going to be exactly front page news. Fine, fair enough. But it was particularly sad because one of my favorite records for this past year, not just Canadian in general, maybe one of my favorite records of the past like 5 years, honestly, or at least kind of up there, is up for the prize. And I feel like if we just had an iota of sort of artistic pride in ourselves, we would be sort of jazzed about it, and we're not. And it's not, unfortunately, Jeremy Dutcher's album, who is a friend and a fantastic musician, it's not his. It's Cindy Lee's Diamond Jubilee. Have you listened to this album?
I have not.
You won't find it streaming anywhere. This is, I think, maybe he's turned some people off the album. You can only get it via her GeoCities page.
Oh, that's cool, though.
You know, Cindy Lee.
Now I want to listen to it.
Yeah, it's so good. Cindy Lee is sort of a drag artist slash fuzzy lo-fi indie musician slash a whole bunch of other stuff. But the record's available on YouTube, but mainly through the GeoCities page, because they are boycotting the pro-war, pro-capitalism, pro-etc. stance of Spotify, Apple, and everybody else. And frankly, awesome, fun. The album is so good. It's a double album that can only be described as music coming from a haunted doll. And I think it is one of the most fun, ingenious, clever, fantastic, listenable, exciting records I've heard in ages, and I just think it is due for a little bit more hurrah.
I love that. I'll have to listen to it after this. Duly noted.
Before we go, stay tuned for some more stories we've been following this week, including an update on who's actually won the Polaris Prize. But first, let's say goodbye to our guest, Paris. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, I enjoyed the conversation.
If you want to hear more from Paris on tech, they should check out your podcast, Tech Won't Save Us. But where can people find your book, for example?
Yeah, my book is Road to Nowhere, What Silicon Valley Gets Wrong About the Future of Transportation. Guess at any bookstore where they want to check it out. Or, you know, if you do the e-reading thing, I'm sure it's on those platforms too. But it was great to join you.
Here's some more stories we're following this week. First, we have the results from the Polaris Prize. The Polaris Prize was awarded to, dun-dun-dun, unbelievably talented, brilliant Montreal-based vocalist Jeremy Dutcher. He's the first Polaris Prize winner to ever win twice, and honestly, good for him. Absolutely, everyone go buy his album, Metal Will Nuke. I'm still riding for Cindy Lee, but okay, you know what? Fair enough. Maybe you lose when you refuse to do press and you cancel your tour midway through. Whatever. Congrats to Jeremy. We've been following this other story for quite a while. Bello Sun, a Canadian mining company, is trying to build the largest open-pit gold mine in Brazil, but locals are protesting the human rights abuses and environmental impacts associated with the project. Bello Sun, in turn, filed a criminal lawsuit against them. Now, the fact that Bello Sun is threatening activists has gotten the attention of the UN. Charisse Sutren digs deep with the UN Special Rapporteur on Monday. Federal politics has, as I'm sure you're well aware, been a mess in Canada over the last couple of weeks. On Tuesday, we take stock of what's been happening and where we're headed. Plus, we're introducing our new host, Noor Azria. We will also be talking about the two shocking and sophisticated Israeli attacks on Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria, involving exploding pagers and walkie-talkies and solar panels. You know, these attacks have injured thousands and resulted in over 20 deaths. Obviously, this is a huge international story. It may signal the start of a wider regional war and the recognition of assassination as a tool of international affairs, okay? But it's also a big deal for Canadians. The Lebanese community in Canada includes between 200 and 400,000 people, while an estimated 40 to 75,000 Canadians live in Lebanon. On Wednesday, we'll take a look at how this is affecting them. In lighter news, the federal court has upheld a decision from the Canada Revenue Agency determining that Ezra Levant's Rebel News is, in fact, not a qualified journalism organization. The court agreed that the Rebel, quote, did not follow journalistic processes and principles, and that it took a, quote, activist stance. Therefore, the Rebel will not be recognized as a qualified journalism organization and won't be able to benefit from the Trudeau government's sweet, sweet tax breaks and subsidies. Poor guys. That's our show for today. Thank you for inviting me into your ears. You can email me at justinling@protonmail.com. I swear to God, I'll read it. This episode is brought to you by Kathleen Nielsen, Broderick Lang, and Alexis Ovenden. Canada Labs workshops are starting this fall. We are excited to open our doors to host three events for journalists and audio makers. And maybe that's you. These workshops are designed to get emerging journalists and audio makers into a room with our team of journalists and editors, featured guests, and industry leaders, all to build crucial skills and a foundational network of colleagues and collaborators. Click the link in the show notes to find out more details about how to register. This episode is produced by James Nicholson, with additional production by Caleb Thompson, audio recording and engineering by Tristan Capicchioni. Our production manager is Max Collins. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Is Bird Note. When a northern saw-whet owl spreads its wings, many birds can see something our human eyes can't. The owl's flight feathers glow. It's invisible to humans without the help of an ultraviolet blacklight, which reveals a bright magenta color. Producing this otherworldly light is a trait called photoluminescence. While some bird feathers simply reflect UV light, photoluminescence involves special pigments or structures in the feathers that absorb UV and then release light of their own, often in a different color. Some cases of luminous feathers have an apparent purpose. For example, parakeets called budgerigars have glowing feathers on their crowns and cheeks that may help them stand out to mates. Over 50 species of parrots, as well as some toucans, have similar gleaming ornaments. But for other birds, such as owls, we still don't have a good idea for the reason behind the glow. The luminous owl wings do have a specific use for biologists, though. Scientists realized that they could estimate an owl's age based on the pattern of luminescent color on the wings, which changes predictably as birds grow and replace their feathers. It's a practical application of a beautiful mystery. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.